Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1. The Apostle Paul writes, "Now, concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But I say this as a concession, not as a commandment. For I wish that all men were even as I myself, but each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that." Now it's been a couple of weeks, it's been a couple of months since we were last in 1 Corinthians, because we took a small break to talk about the Protestant Reformation. So now we're going to be back in 1 Corinthians doing a verse-by-verse exposition of the letter. And we stopped at a good point at the end of chapter 6, because now in chapter 7 begins a whole new section. If you recall, Paul is writing to the church in Corinth because the church in Corinth has a lot of problems. One of the issues that they have, something that comes up again and again in the letter, is there's arguments among them as to who is more spiritual, who is holier, who is better. There's divisions in the church, there's schisms, and there's little cliques and groups, one saying, "Oh, we're better than you because we're like this, or because we have certain spiritual gifts that are better than you," and we'll see that later on. There's been legal problems in the church, there's been sexual problems in the church, we've looked at all that, and Paul has basically spent the last six chapters yelling at them for their immaturity. They think they're really spiritual, but they're actually quite foolish and immature. But 1 Corinthians is not just Paul yelling at them. Paul and the church in Corinth have been having communication. They've been having a correspondence. They've been sending letters to one another. Paul has written to them, and they have been writing to him. And he apparently received a letter from them where they were talking about a number of issues. Now, I don't know if they were asking questions in this letter. It may have been that they were just stating, "Well, this is what we believe." I don't know. And so, starting in chapter 7, and for the next few chapters, he's going to be addressing certain issues that they talked about in their letter to him. All right? So, what is chapter 7 about? Clearly, if you just do a quick reading of chapter 7, clearly we see that there's a lot about marriage. And there is. There's a lot about marriage. Now, sadly, a lot from this chapter has been misunderstood and misapplied for a long time in church history. A long time. Starting end of 3rd century, beginning of 4th century, this chapter was basically used to promote the idea that it is holier and more spiritual to be single and celibate rather than to be married. Even the great St. Augustine, sadly, when speaking of intercourse in marriage, even spoke of it as a necessary evil. So for centuries, the church has kind of taken this, many in the church have kind of taken this route because of this chapter. And so you have, for example, Roman Catholic priests and nuns who are not allowed to marry. In the Greek Orthodox Church, again, it's not as strict as it is in the Roman Catholic Church, but again, there's rules there for many of the priests who are not allowed to get married. Why? Because they believe that celibacy is holier and more spiritual than being married. Now, Why do they say this? What do they find in this chapter to say, well, it's holier to be celibate? Well, Paul himself was single. And he enjoyed being single. He liked being single. He didn't need to get married. He didn't want to be married. And so he gives a number of reasons why it's perfectly good to be single and why he likes being single. And he talks about the benefits of being single. And so people take those passages and wrongly assume that he is saying, therefore it is holier and better, and to be married is a lower form of spirituality. Now, of course, that is not Paul's intention. That is not Paul's intention at all. In fact, his intention is the exact opposite. I want to give you a quick analysis of the entire chapter, so you see what the main focus is, so that when we start breaking down each paragraph, we can understand it in light of the main theme. Even though marriage is something that is mentioned again and again, and it is one of the major themes in this chapter, there is something behind this. There is a larger and more important concept behind all of this. If you read the chapter, it starts off and it talks about married people. Then he talks about single people. Then he talks about divorced people. Then he seems to go off on a tangent and he says, by the way, circumcision or uncircumcision, doesn't matter if you're circumcised or uncircumcised, it makes no difference. If you're free or a slave, doesn't matter if you're free or a slave. If you're uncircumcised, don't worry about getting circumcised. If you're a slave, or if you're free, don't worry about, you know, that. Or if you're a slave, don't worry about that. It doesn't matter what your state is in life, whether you're circumcised, uncircumcised, free, or slave. It doesn't matter. What matters is to be obedient to God. That's what matters. To be holy in whatever state you're in. It's not that it's holier to be circumcised or holier to be uncircumcised, holier to be a slave or holier to be free. What matters is to obey God. Look at this in verse 19. Really quick, verse 19. He says, circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing, but keeping the commandments of God is what matters. If you want to be holy, keep the commandments of God. Be obedient to God. Okay? And then all of a sudden he goes back to marriage again. And he talks about virgins, and he talks about widows, and he talks about married women, and so forth. And you're like, what just happened there in the middle of the chapter? Are we talking about marriage, and then he goes off talking about something else, and he says, oh, let's talk about marriage again. And he goes back to talking about marriage. Or are all these things tied together? The one thing that you will find throughout the entirety of the chapter, and the sections that are talking about marriage, and the section where he's talking about circumcision and being free or being a slave and all these things, the one concept that is common throughout the chapter is not seeking to change your status, thinking that that will make you somehow more spiritual. The whole chapter, he starts off, the question is, this is something that the Corinthians are talking about all the time. What is more spiritual? I'm more spiritual than you because I do this. Oh, no, I'm more spiritual than you because I'm like this. And so here, now the question is, what's more spiritual? Should I be married or should I be single? Should I be celibate or should I have sexual relations? Should I be circumcised or should I be uncircumcised? Should I be free or should I be a slave? What should I do? And Paul says, it's neither the one nor the other. It's not that one makes you holier than the other. In whatever state you're in, whether you're married, unmarried, divorced, single, celibate, circumcised, uncircumcised, free, slave, whoever you are, whatever position you are in, be holy in the state that you are in. You don't need to change your status to become holier. That is what is behind the entirety of the chapter. And I think if we understand that theme, it'll help us understand better a number of things that are mentioned throughout the letter. All right? The overarching theme of the chapter is, do not seek to change your status thinking that that'll make you more spiritual. Now, clearly, some in Corinth are saying that it is holier to be single and celibate. All right. So this is something that this is something that was taught in the ancient world. Something that is taught today. Many ancient religions taught this, that it is holier to be celibate rather than to have those kinds of relationships. You had philosophies in the ancient world that taught this, like the Stoics. You had the Gnostics. Some of the Gnostics taught these things. And of course, Roman Catholicism and Greek Orthodoxy have also fallen into that trap, into thinking the same thing. So then, you have certain people in Corinth who are urging others to be single or celibate, because that is holier, that is more spiritual. So now, the people in Corinth who are married have certain questions. What do I do? If it's holier to be single and I'm married, what should I do? Should I divorce and be single? Especially if I'm married to an unbeliever. Maybe then it would be better to go and divorce and be single. Or, you know what, maybe it's not right to divorce because, you know, we shouldn't divorce. Maybe if it's holier to be celibate, I'll just abstain within marriage. And so these are the issues that Paul is going to be addressing. And these are some of the things that he is talking about in the first seven verses of 1 Corinthians. That was the introduction. Okay? Now, let's look at the text. Chapter 7, verse 1. He starts off, "Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me." So they sent him a letter concerning these things, right? What is it? "It is good for a man not to touch a woman." Now, there's a debate here amongst theologians about that statement. The debate is, the statement, "It is good for a man not to touch a woman." The statement, the debate is on whether, is this Paul's own statement? Is this Paul's own feelings, belief? Or could it be that he is quoting the Corinthians? In other words, there are many theologians who think, and this is not a modern idea, you can find this in the ancient church too. There are many theologians who believe that in essence what he's saying, "Now concerning those things that you wrote to me," specifically, that it's good for a man not to touch a woman. That this was their concept and he is now going to address it. Why, in fact, in some translations, they have that phrase in quotation marks. Okay? As though it's not his. "Concerning those things that you wrote," quote, "that it's good for a man not to touch a woman," end quote. Why do some theologians assume this? Number one, there are a number of places in 1 Corinthians where Paul does indeed quote them and then corrects them or qualifies what they just said. So they say this is possibly the same thing here. Second reason is because this idea of celibacy doesn't really fit Paul's Jewish heritage, shall we say. It doesn't really fit what the Old Testament teaches or at all what Jewish tradition would teach. In the Old Testament, sex within marriage is considered a good, holy thing. The holiest people that you can find in the Old Testament were married. Moses, Enoch, Isaiah, Job, these were all the holiest people alive, and they were married. And so, some people say there is no way that Paul would say, yes, it's good to be celibate, not touch a woman. Perhaps. On the other hand, it is possible that this is Paul's statement because he was single. He enjoyed being single. And the thing is, even if this is indeed Paul's statement, that he is saying it's good for a man not to touch a woman, we need to understand that we can't take this as an absolute statement. Okay? It's not that he is saying being celibate is good, therefore getting married is bad. He's not saying that at all. He is simply saying, it's good. There's nothing wrong with being single. If you're single, it's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. Okay? It's good. Imagine if we were going to take this statement, it's good for a man not to touch a woman, in the absolute sense. Okay? Adam and Eve would have been the last two people on earth. Okay? God creates Adam. He says it's not good for man to be alone. And what does he do? Gives him a wife. Says, be fruitful. Multiply. Imagine if Adam said, no, it's not good for a man to touch a woman. Well, that would be the end of that. And that's the end of the human race. Right? So you can't just take this as an absolute statement above everything else and say, okay, can't do that. So we need to, even if this is Paul's statement himself, can't go overboard with it. He's simply saying that it's a good thing. Now, verse 2. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Now, someone may say, so is Paul saying that we should get married so we don't fall into sexual immorality? It doesn't sound like a very noble reason to get married. Well, here's the thing. Paul here is not giving us an exhaustive list of reasons for marriage. This was a problem in Corinth. If you remember, just in chapter 6, just a few verses ago, it was talking about how some of them were going to prostitutes and things, all right? So they have a problem here, and so he is specifically having that in mind, all right? He's not giving us every reason for marriage, but it's one of them. Let me give you reasons for marriage, biblically. Number one, to have children. God has Adam and Eve, be fruitful, multiply. He marries them, they have children. Another reason for marriage, partnership. It's not good for man to be alone. And God creates a helper for him. Now you have two. Ecclesiastes says two is better than one. Because if one falls down, the other one can pick him up. Alright? Two is better than one. You have partnership. You have help. And especially in the case of a woman who is weaker physically, you have the man to protect her too. So there's mutual help and partnership. Also, according to this passage here, reason for marriage is to fulfill physical needs that people have. Now I know that there are that Roman Catholic... Actually, I know about Greek Orthodox. I haven't looked into it with Roman Catholics. The Greek Orthodox would disagree with that statement. They say, no, it's not for fulfilling physical needs at all. In fact, they say, if you've had the children that you have had, you stop. That's the Greek Orthodox position. Of course, I don't know what you do with Song of Solomon, what you do with half the book of Proverbs. I don't know what you do with this passage, which seems that it's perfectly good and natural and normal to have those physical relationships within marriage. Marriage is also a picture of Christ and His church above all. And so, husband and wife are to reflect the relationship between Christ and His church. And, according to this passage, we have marriage being protection against fornication and sexual immorality, for purity. Later on, a couple of verses from now, he's going to say, if you don't have self-control, it's better to marry than to burn in passion. So, no problem with that. He says it's good to be single. It's also good to be married. Verse 3. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. In contrast to anyone in Corinth who may be saying that celibacy is good even within marriage, and marriage you should abstain, Paul says absolutely not. That's the worst idea ever. There is no place for celibacy in marriage. You're not meant to live as a single when you are married. All right? Just as we always talk about that outside of marriage, it would be wrong to have sexual relationships, likewise, within marriage, it would be wrong not to. It is part of married life. And let me quickly point out here that it doesn't say, wives, you owe this to your husbands. He turns it around and says, husbands, you owe this to your wives also. He puts husband and wife on the same level, exactly, when it comes to this issue, this mutuality. And let me point out here, I know it's not going to sound romantic at all, but Paul presents it here as an obligation. He says, render the affection due her. The Greek word is ophili. Ophilo is something that you owe, something that is owed. If you buy something and you say, this is ophilo, what do I owe you? Okay, that's the word that is used here. In Exodus 21, it talks about a man taking a wife, and it says, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, and her marriage rights. Once you enter into the covenant of marriage, you have certain obligations, which include coming together physically. And as a quick side note here, I was thinking about this, how Paul is saying, this is how it must be within marriage. I can't help thinking of the Roman Catholic Church and the Greek Orthodox Church when they talk about Mary, where they say that she must have remained a virgin her entire life because she is just too pure to sleep with her husband. Well, according to this passage, it would actually be wrong on her behalf to not sleep with her husband because that is the natural way of marriage, but that's just a side note. Verse 4, the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. When you get married, you give up the exclusive rights to yourself. You are now joined to another person. The two become one. And a man's body belongs to his wife, and the wife's body belongs to her husband. This is the plan for marriage, and it excludes celibacy. You're not single anymore. The two come together and you belong to one another. And let me do another side note. I got a lot of side notes today. Let me do another side note here. I want you to realize how radical it is what Paul is saying about women in this verse 2,000 years ago. All right? Because everyone would agree, the wife's body belongs to the husband. Sure, but he turns around and says the husband's body belongs to the wife. Husband is not like, well, I'm the head, so I do whatever I want. No, your body belongs to your wife, and only to your wife. She has authority over you when it comes to this issue. All right? This is for all the people who say, oh, the Bible is, you know, anti-women, and Paul was misogynistic, and all these things. I'm like, not according to this. He's putting husband and wife on the exact same level when it comes to this issue. You won't find anything else like this in the ancient world. Anywhere. Speaking of a woman having authority over her husband's body. But Paul does. Alright, well, so, we belong to one another. What should we do, Paul? Verse 5. Do not deprive one another, except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again, so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So once you're married, your body belongs to your spouse, you have certain obligations, do not deprive one another. But, he says, I'll allow an exception under certain conditions. I'll allow you to abstain under certain conditions. And only under these conditions. What are the conditions? Number one, he says, with consent. There's got to be mutual consent here between the couple. It's not that the one informs the other one, oh, by the way, I'll see you in 6 months. No, hold on, I didn't agree to that. You agree to this together. Number two, for a time, for a specific time. It's not indefinite. It's not like, okay, we're abstaining and we'll see. No, he says it has to be for a specific time. Number three, it has to be for a specific purpose, and that is prayer. I know that my translation says fasting and prayer. Fasting is probably not an original text. It's not a good, it's a textual variant and it's not that good. For prayer, it has to be for a specific reason that you abstain. And he says for prayer, there are certain times in your life, there may be some kind of crisis in your life where you need to put everything aside for prayer. Paul says that's fine. In that case, it's okay. But when you're done with that specific time in your life of prayer, he says, come together again so that Satan does not tempt you. Satan knows how easy it is for people to fall into sexual sin, especially men. And so Satan is going to try and tempt you. And so Paul says, don't deprive one another with your spouse. Don't stay away from each other for too long. And if anyone says to me, Nico, how much is too long? I'm not going to answer that. I'll let each couple decide for themselves what's too long. Just be aware that Satan will try to use your lack of self-control to get you to sin. And so Paul says, don't leave it for too long. Verse 6. But I say this as a concession, not as a commandment. So the question is, well, what is he conceding to? What is he allowing? But it's not a commandment. Well, the only thing in the passage where he has just said, maybe you could do this, but not necessarily, is where he's allowed for them to abstain for a while. He says, maybe, if you agree, if it's for prayer, if you make sure it's not too long, maybe I'll allow it. So I think he's just saying, you can abstain for a while if you want, but you don't have to do that. Verse 7, for I wish that all men were even as I myself, but each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. Paul says, I would like it if everyone was like me. What was Paul like? He was single. He was celibate. Now, as a quick side note, it is possible that Paul had been married in the past. It's possible. It's not certain. But even if he had been, he's not anymore. If he was, his wife may have died and he was a widower, or perhaps his wife left him when he became a Christian. We don't know. If he was, these are all speculations. We don't know. But either way, right now he is single. He enjoys being single, and he says, I'd like it if everyone was like me. But, he says, I understand that that's not for everyone. All right, I like being single, and later on in the chapter he's going to give us reasons why he likes being single, because it helps being a missionary, not having to worry about wife and kids and stuff like that, all right? But, he says, I understand that not everyone has the same gift that I have from God. My gift, he says, is to be single. And it's not singleness itself that is the gift. It's being single and not needing to get married, not needing to have that kind of physical relationship with anyone. He's fine the way he is. He's like, that's my gift from God, but I understand that is not for everyone. Others have a different gift. I have my gift, others have their own gift. Others have the gift of marriage. That's what God has given you. So, it's all good. We're different. God gives gifts as he wills. It's all fine. It's basically the same thing that Jesus said in Matthew 19. If you remember in Matthew 19, Jesus is talking about divorce and marriage and remarriage and all these things, and he basically says, once you get married, you're stuck. That's it. And the disciples say, well, if you're stuck, you might as well not get married at all. And Jesus says, well, hold on. It's not for everyone. Maybe. But maybe not. It's not that, well, this is the best and this is worse. No. Some people, who have the gift that Paul had, fine. Others, no. Get married. So Paul, in essence, is saying, I would like it if everyone was like me, but I understand that that's really out of the question. That's not going to happen because that's not how God made us. So, there's a lot more in this chapter which is more difficult than today's passage. Let me just close. Is marriage good? Yes, it is. It's a gift from God. Singleness can also be good. And it can also be a gift from God if it's the kind of singleness that Paul has. Physical relationship within marriage, is it good? Yes, it's a gift from God. Also, celibacy can also be a gift from God, as with Paul. One is not better than the other. Wherever you are in life, live accordingly. If you are married, don't pretend to be single. And if you're single, don't pretend to be married. Wherever you are in life, live a holy life that is pleasing to God in that state in which you are in. Thank you for your attention. Let's pray.